From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Okay, where do you go for a dish of hokey pokey, enjoy a cold stubby, go tramping, put on some togs and jandals, and head to a beach in the Wop Wops? Well, my guest Anne Aldane will tell you it's all good in her native New Zealand. Anne is an icon in the world of women's track and long-distance racing. She qualified for 6 Olympic Games during her career, which included a world record in the 5,000 meters and gold and silver medals in the Commonwealth Games, and a long list of top finishes in major road races around the world. Anne has been called the winningest road racer in history and became the first professional female contract athlete when she signed with the shoemaker Nike in 1981. Anne Aldane is now a Hoosier, a U.S. citizen, living in Evansville with her husband, Chuck Hubry. Anne Aldane chronicles her growing up in New Zealand, overcoming deformities to both feet, coping with a tyrannical coach, and her ups and downs both on and off the track in her autobiography, Uncommon Heart. Anne Aldane, welcome to 2 Main Street, and I understand you just returned from Boise?
I did. Before I met Chuck and moved to Evansville, I lived in Boise was my training base in the United States. And when I retired in 1992, I had to make a decision whether to go back to New Zealand or choose to stay here in the United States. And I chose to stay here. And I founded a big event, a running event out in Boise in 1993. And it's still going strong. So for 27 years, I go back there, and I'm still involved with it, and it's really doing well.
Well, how many people are involved in that Boise event?
12,710, wow, to be exact, because they're very accurate in terms of how they give out their numbers. But it's, yeah, for Boise, Idaho, because, you know, obviously there's bigger events around the nation, but Boise is so isolated. And so 90% of these participants are actually coming from one county.
And it's a celebration of women.
Well, it was. Now, it was for the first 20 years. When I founded it, it was a women's only 5K. And we built it to be the largest 5K for women in the nation, to 17,000 participants. The reason I founded it was because in the early 90s, the average woman, and certainly women over the age of 40, certainly women that were not in shape to really be out wanting to run, they did not enter mixed running events. And so I wanted to begin an event where everyone was welcome. All shapes, sizes, abilities, all women were welcome. So that's why I founded it, was to encourage women to come out and do these events. Now, fast forward 20 years, where the women's event in Boise was starting to dwindle in numbers, that wasn't actually a negative thing. The positive side of that was that women now realized they could go out and enter all the mixed events and were doing so. So 7 years ago, we made the big change and turned it into Fit One, and it's a 5K, 10K, and half marathon, and we're back up to almost 13,000.
And still going strong. Okay, now before we go on, Anne, let's define some of the Kiwi slang I mentioned earlier. What is hokey pokey?
Hokey pokey is an ice cream. And it would probably be, now it's unique, so it's certainly not the same as praline, but that would be the closest in the United States is the flavor praline or praline, mm-hmm, however you say it. So it's hokey pokey ice cream.
Okay. A stubby.
That is a small can of beer.
Okay. A stubby. So that could be any brand?
Any brand. Okay. It's just the small cans of beer.
Okay. A stubby. If I want to go tramping, what does that mean?
Hiking in the bush.
Okay.
On bush trails.
All right. Togs.
Bathing suit.
Okay. Jandals.
Flip-flops.
Oh, okay. And my favorite, the Wop Wops.
Now, that one I don't know.
Okay, I looked that one up, and it's like going into the boondocks.
Oh, that's okay.
The sticks.
Okay, into the, yes, you're right. That's a little bit more of an Australian New Zealand. But
well, maybe
yes, you're right, though.
Parts
right.
of New Zealand. Maybe.
Yes,
you got
yes.
two big islands in New Zealand.
Yes,
you got the
yes.
north and south, so
uh-huh.
it may be
yes.
restricted to one of the islands. There. Okay, now, you were adopted as a child, but in your book, Uncommon Heart, You say you never felt unwanted because of a story your adopted father told you.
Yes. So from the moment I could understand, parents, kids, whatever, they, you know, where'd you come from, whatever. And so my dad would always tell me a story that he and mum couldn't have children, so they decided to adopt, and they went to a home where there were a whole bunch of little babies in a row, and mum really wanted a boy, but he wanted a girl. And so they walked down, and there were all these babies, and when they got to the end, that I was the only one that smiled at them. And that, you know, that I was very special because not many parents get to choose their children. And that was the story he always told me. Mum wasn't so outgoing with telling everybody I was adopted, but Dad was always really proud. And, you know, it gives you a sense of security that you're special, you're really special. Well, that was not actually a true story, as we would all find out later. But, you know, it was a nice way of, you know, saying, you know, we adopted you, you were special, we chose you. And I just think that gives you a really strong foundation as an adopted child.
Now, in your book, you talk about your childhood in New Zealand and the time you spent with Nana on the island of Waiheke, right off, right from Auckland, the city of sails, I think. Auckland.
Yes, 25 miles from the harbor of Auckland. Yes.
So you take a ferry to get there?
Yes. Took a ferry. We actually lived 10 miles out of downtown Auckland in a suburb, and you know, Auckland. Auckland's huge now. I mean, Auckland's 1.4 million people, but when I was young, we even had a dirt road from our house 2 miles up, and my dad would catch a bus and ride a bus into the city each day to go to work. And
he was working for the newspaper, right?
Yes, he was a printer for the New Zealand, a linotype operator. You know what that is.
Because when I started at the Evansville Courier, and that's what it was, hot type.
That's it.
Hot type.
Yeah.
And they would put everything in linotype machines and it clanks and everything. Very noisy printing area. And read the print upside down.
That's right. Well, see, my dad would take me to work with him. And I jokingly say he taught me to read upside down.
So, you had to read the proofs.
You had to read the proofs upside down. And we would go and... This is amazing when you think about, you know, the world these days. My mum and dad would put me, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. They would put me on a bus into the city, and they would find somebody going from our suburb into the city to mind me on the bus. And then they'd get me to the wharf, and I would ride the boat down to the island, and they'd find somebody on the boat to take care of me until I got to the island. And then I'd ride another bus to where my Nana's cottage was. And it was all to do with finding people to trust to get this child all the way down. I spent so much time on that island with my grandmother. And, you know, just a very simple way of life where there's no running water on the island. So there's no sewage. So you have to catch rainwater in a tank and boil the rainwater to use it for drinking and so forth. You know, in the outhouse, you know, the outside toilets. And so very simple life. And at that point, early on, no electricity. And so I learned I always said that her very simple life and the discipline of a simple life really was instrumental in me knowing how to be a professional athlete. Because as a fast forward to being a professional athlete, all you're doing is eating, sleeping, training, competing. So learning how to live a simple life and entertain yourself in quiet times when there's, you know, you can't exert any energy. I think I learned so much of that from her and that little cottage on the island.
My guest is Anne Aldane, an Olympic athlete, a world-class runner, and we're talking about her autobiography, Uncommon Heart. And Anne, you were an unlikely athlete as a child because of your foot deformities. Tell us about that.
Well, I, you know, like all kids, you start to walk at whatever age. And so my parents noticed that I wasn't using the front part of my feet very much. I was shuffling along very pigeon-toed and on the back of my heels, on my heels. And so as time went by, as my feet grew, it showed that there were big bone deformities growing, almost like very, very, very severe bunions. That's the only way I can look at it. And as much as you're mentioning the book, there's actually a documentary film just come out. And in that film, early on, we actually found the doctor that did the surgery on my feet. He explains it really well, what the problem was. But when I was young, none of us knew, and it caused me an awful lot of pain. So I would not go up on the front part of my feet, and I couldn't wear normal shoes. So my dad would get slippers and cut holes in the sides so that these bones would stick out so there was no pressure on them. It was just very painful. So when we went to the doctors, they actually told my parents that they didn't want to do surgery until I was a teenager, until my bones were strong enough to handle the surgery and recover from the surgery to give me the best chance possible to use my feet correctly. And so they waited until I was 13 years of age, which was very, very difficult on me as a kid because I couldn't, you know, participate in a lot of things because it was just too painful.
So did you have to wear special shoes?
No. I had those little slippers in the wintertime, and then in the summer we'd find leather sandals, kind of like Tevas, and Dad would cut the straps so that they'd fit. But you know, the climate that I grew up in was kind of mild, you know, so I could get away being barefoot a lot as well. And so, yeah, it was hard. I just wasn't capable of running or walking really well, but I did it. I mean, kids adapt to all sorts of things. So at 13, they decided to do the surgery in the hopes that they would get my gait better and mm-hmm. that I would use the front part of my feet. The greatest thing was finding this doctor. He was in his 80s when we finally found him. And to listen to him, it just really validates, because otherwise people go, oh, yeah, right. You know, you had all those problems and look how you turned out. And to listen to him validate it and explain what it was just real, really cool.
Now, you said you had a kind of a Forrest Gump moment when you were able to, I guess, wear normal shoes and run. So it was Run, Annie, Run?
Yeah, you know, when I saw that movie, when he's running through the fields and the braces all come off, it brought tears to my eyes because it's exactly what happened to me. Those plaster casts came off my feet. My feet looked like everybody else's. And I had a running gait. It was easier for me to run now than it was to walk. And even now, I fall back sometimes when I'm out walking, that I fall back into the old kind of gait a little bit, very pigeon-toed. But my running style is absolutely perfect.
So when did you know you had a running talent? When did that hit you?
Well, after a year after having the surgery and going through the rehab, track and field and athletic clubs were huge in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And in New Zealand, all sports are administered in a club situation. They're not administered in a school situation. So my schoolmates and my neighbor, you know, they all belong to the Otahuhu Athletic Club, track and field club. And so I just wanted to join too. I had no idea what I was doing. It's just I wanted to go and be like everybody else.
It was a social?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was. It was absolutely amazing because the club had kids from 5 years of age to adults 90 years of age. I mean, it was very much a community club.
Okay.
And they would have a club night on a Wednesday night, and you would go, and the little ones would start first, and then the older ones would administer the younger ones, and then the adults would administer them. I mean, it was just a huge family, big, big family affair. And then Saturdays, the clubs would compete against each other. You'd have inter-club competitions. So very much club-oriented. And so I started off just doing sprints, but they encouraged you to try long jump and shot put and high jump, and I didn't want to jump at all on these feet, but they encouraged you to try everything. But when it came to the running, which at that point was only 100 and 200 meters, I just found that I actually had pretty good speed. Now, I ended up being an endurance runner, but at that point, I was pretty good speed too. So I just found that I loved to run and got encouraged by a neighbor to run in a half-mile race in the Auckland Championships, enter as a 14-year-old against adults. And I finished third. And that's where my first coach saw me run.
Well, that first coach, I know he's prominent in your book, Gordon Peary.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon Peary came knocking on your parents' door wanting to be your coach. And he's described by both yourself and others as domineering and emotionally unstable. And we're going to hear about Gordon Peary later on. And also, we're going to hear about Ann's rigorous training routine, those first big races, her Olympic memories, and later how my guest, Ann Aldane, broke down barriers for today's female athletes. Stay with us. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport.
Support for 2 Main Street with David James comes from listeners like you and from Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management, guiding clients through all stages of their financial lives to help them achieve long-term peace of mind. Details at BergerWealthServices.com.
Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and my guest is Ann Aldane, a runner who excelled in both track meets and road races in her native New Zealand, the U.S., Europe, and around the world, setting a world record, qualifying for 6 Olympic Games, and becoming the first professional female distance runner when she signed with Nike, thus paving the way for today's female athletes. Okay, Ann, we've got the Gordon Peary. He's your first coach, quite a character. Tell us about this training routine, no pain, no gain.
Yeah, Gordon was British. He immigrated to New Zealand in the late 60s. He was an Olympic medalist. He had a very domineering personality, almost a Jekyll and Hyde, because he could be real charming as well. That's how he could kind of got away with a lot of, because he could switch. But anyway, he was coach of the running club that I joined, and he had a group of young athletes, probably about 30 or 40 of us, variety of age, you know, from young maybe through to 20s and a few 30s, and he would get us all together on our training nights, which were typically Tuesdays and Thursdays and Sundays, but the whole thing with him was that he played us all against each other, and he never had any plans. It was really all about him, because he was still running quite well, and it was like he was challenging all of us to race him all the time, and he just knew everything, and he was the best, and so he would play us, male and female, or against each other. He would ridicule the guys if they couldn't keep up with me, and then he'd play me off against some of the other gals, and it was just a very there was no consistency, no planning. You just turned up to train each day. And if he was in a bad mood, then we all really heard about it, and we all just had to run like crazy. And he would wear us out. So we were never, ever really well prepared to race well. And for me, I look back now because, like, how did I survive? People go, how come? You were with him for 10 years. I think I had the mentality where, for want of a better word, that it worked positive for me, I don't know, but I had a mentality, well, I'm just going to show you. He destroyed a lot of other athletes in the meantime. I just think I persevered, and it was just, I'm just going to show you that I can do this. I think that saved me. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I had to quit with him too, because he was just going crazy.
Well, you did persevere, and you managed to go to the Olympic Games in Montreal in 1976. That had to be, how old were you then?
20. I was 20 years old, and I was in my first year as an elementary school teacher. So that kind of shows you the education system as we go through much faster. I had already been through 3 years of teachers' college and had my first elementary school class at the age of 20.
So
and that was
school,
an Olympic year.
You're a school teacher, and then you're going to the Olympic Games. Wow, what an exciting adventure.
Yeah.
So what was that like?
Well, it was I was New Zealand's champion at 800 and 1500 meters and New Zealand record holder, and was starting to, you know, certainly get a lot of publicity, because up until then, New Zealand's track and field history was dominated by the men. And we had great, I mean, we had generations of mile world record holders and Olympic medalists, and so all the history was predominantly men. And so here was this young girl now getting all the attention and running times that were really fast for my age. And so, you know, I'm going off to Montreal, and I've got a class and a school full of little kids, and they're all following their teacher going to the Olympics. And boy, she's so good, and she's going to come back with a medal. And of course, the reality of the Olympic Games is you've got to go through the heats and the quarterfinals and the semifinals to, in the 800 meters, there's only 8 in the final, and then the 1500 meters, there's only 12 in the final. So I get to Montreal, and I line up in the 800 meters, and I'm last in my heat, running a pretty good time. Not my best time, but really close to it. And that's really devastating. Maybe you don't expect at 20 years of age to get all the way through, but to finish last in your first heat is pretty devastating. And so I really didn't want to run the 1500 meters. And of course, you know, the managers was like, well, you're here to run two events, so, you know, a few days time you line up in the 1500 meters, which I did. And I actually ran my fastest time, a new New Zealand record, but it wasn't enough to get me out of that first round either. So, you know, you're 20 years of age, you go back to New Zealand, and the whole country expected you to get a medal, and all these little kids, and, well, didn't kind of work out that way. But, you know, history shows that the 76 Olympics were, on the female side, just full of drug cheats from the Eastern Bloc. And, you know, so at 20 years of age, I was running really well, but I was up against that too. Do you know there's still two women from those Olympics that still hold the world record?
And they haven't
in the 400 meters. Well, they're considering it, actually. Right now, the IAAF is considering annihilating every woman's world record in track and field.
Really?
Because they consider them all.
My goodness. So, okay, did you go back to New Zealand after the Olympics then?
Yes, I went back and
continued
teaching, mm-hmm. and made New Zealand teams and Commonwealth Games and World Cross Country. And then it came time for the 1980 Olympic Games in Moscow, and I was getting ready to qualify and go to Moscow when President Carter called the boycott, and mm-hmm. New Zealand, as many other countries did too, mm-hmm. Joined in the boycott.
Boycotting the Soviet Union
yes.
because of the invasion of Afghanistan.
Yeah, I know.
Which is
isn't that a history?
Yeah, a big circle there, definitely.
Oh, well, I know.
History. I know your history. And the title of your book, Uncommon Heart, based on a physical examination you had, and the doctor said, yeah, you do have an uncommon heart. It's larger than normal.
For a little girl, yes. When they were doing the prep for the foot surgery, they came out to my parents and said that they thought there was another issue, that I had a very large heart for a tiny girl, so that they would have to monitor that. Well, you know, fast forward, I ended up being a really good endurance athletes for that.
So you think that's played a part in
oh,
your
oh, yes, I do. Yeah, I have
your
a really
athletic
strong
ability.
Yes, absolutely.
Well,
yep.
Okay, now let's talk about a highlight of your career, the world record at Mount Smart Stadium in your hometown of Auckland in March of 1982.
Well, that wasn't going to happen for the very reason, and we'll probably touch on it later. But at that moment in time, I had gone back to New Zealand as a banned athlete internationally because I had chosen to take money in the sport, and that was illegal as an amateur athlete. So I went back to New Zealand from the United States that summer and was banned from running in New Zealand at that time. And my coach, my new coach at that point, said, you know, you need to, you know, have a goal to get out and continue training while we're going through this issue. And he says, I think you could break the world record in the 5,000 meters. And I had watched the great Greta Weitz, who's the 9-time champion of New York Marathon, miss the 5,000 meter world record in an attempt. Actually, in New Zealand, I sat in the stands and watched her miss it, and I had no idea that I would have any kind of talent like Greta. So when John says this, you can break the world record in the 5,000.
Who's John?
My second coach. I had already joined him. I joined
John
him.
John Davies.
John Davies. I joined him at the end of 1980. And anyway, so I'm like, John, have you lost your mind? I mean, Greta couldn't do it, couldn't break it. You think I can? And he goes, yeah, I think you can. And so we trained, and I did everything he told me. And he was a coach who had a plan. He knew what I had to do. And he had been an Olympic bronze medalist himself, coached under the famous Arthur Lydiard, who all of us in New Zealand are coached on Arthur Lydiard's principles. And so I went out, and the New Zealand Federation allowed me to attempt a world record, but it wasn't allowed to be done at an official track meet. It had to be done as a special attempt, like almost a solo attempt. Hmm. But two other gals agreed to run in the event to make it legal so that there were three participants in the event. So I went out, and I actually broke the world 5,000-meter record the first time I ever raced the distance. So that gave me a lot of confidence in John Davies, that he knew what he was doing.
And then later that same year, the gold medal race in the 3,000 meters at the Commonwealth Games. Now, where was that at?
That was in Brisbane, Australia. Okay. And at that point, I'd come back to the United States in March of 82 after the world record, and went on a kind of rampage. I won every single road race I entered that year. In 82, I broke every course record, and I had no intention, actually, of running track ever again. I was on the road racing circuit here, and that was it. That's what I wanted to do. I'd found my niche, as far as I was concerned. As far as John was concerned, he had other plans. And no New Zealand woman had ever won a track gold medal. And the British Commonwealth Games are a big event. You know, there's 72 countries in the Commonwealth, and many African nations, obviously England, Ireland, Scotland, Canada, a lot of Caribbean countries. So anyway, he had idea that that I should come and attempt the 3,000-meter race and try and win a gold medal. And I refused. I said, I'm not coming back. I don't want to. Don't have to. I'm enjoying running here. It'll mess up my road racing season. Anyway, he just kept working on me and putting on the guilt where, you know, come and do it for your country, do it for your parents. They've never, you know, it's not like they were going to be in Australia, but, you know, do it for everybody that supported you all these years. And so I flew all the way down to Australia, and I was still a banned athlete, and I didn't know whether the ban was going to get lifted for me to run in the Commonwealth Games, but I went all the way there because John had me convinced that he had heard the rumors that I would be freed up to run. So I went down, and I was only ranked like ninth in the Commonwealth in the 3,000 meters because I had not made it any kind of specialty. And he just said, you know, you're in great shape, and I think you got a chance. And I always liked to be a front runner. I didn't like to run tactically. I always got out in front and figured that, you know, I'm going to run as hard as I can. If I get beaten, I get beaten. But I know that I've given it my all versus somebody else controlling how I run. And so he came out. He was going to be commentating for New Zealand television. And he came out and he said, on the warm-up track, and he said, now, Annie, it's really, really windy in the stadium. You got to promise me you won't lead the race today. I think you got a really good kick. Wait for that. But promise me don't lead. I don't think you should do that. And, you know, anybody can go on YouTube and Google my name and Commonwealth gold medal, and you can kind of see that I didn't follow his instructions. But I ended up winning, and I became New Zealand's first female gold medalist on the track. And what is it, 30-something years later, I still am.
Well, good for you. Yeah, that I watched the YouTube documentary, and it starts with the beginning of this race and ends with the finish of the race, the last lap. Wendy Smith of Great Britain is neck and neck with Anne Aldane on the track. going around the bend, I guess, to the finish line, and she pulls ahead of you, I think, briefly, and then what happens?
That kick was there, even though I'd led the race from start to finish. Wendy was actually the European champion and Commonwealth record holder, so she was the favorite. Mm-hmm. And so when I beat her, I beat the European champion and the Commonwealth record holder, and I broke her record. So John commentating for New Zealand television was very happy.
The crowd was going crazy, and I'm sure the aftermath was wonderful.
It was. Where I was a little stuck was that I had to get back to the United States to run some more road races. And so I didn't immediately go back to New Zealand to be celebrated that I would have been if I'd gone right back. I actually flew back through Auckland Airport, and they arranged for my parents to come and see me in the, the lounge where you're mm-hmm, in right. transit, in mm-hmm. the transit lounge. So they made a special thing for them to come and see me, but then I immediately just got on a plane and came back to the United States and raced again. Didn't go back to New Zealand until about 6 weeks later. So I didn't get to go back and really be celebrated by the country, but you know, I had commitments up here, so I had to get back here. So,
well, in your book, you talk about your incredible road racing career in the U.S., all the different large cities and medium-sized cities that had these races, and you were getting some prize money, and actually, that's how you were existing, you and your husband, Steve, mm-hmm. Steve Audane, mm-hmm. and so you're traveling all across the country, and he's flying back and forth, and you have bouts with migraines and flu, foot problems, et cetera, all the things that go with being a professional athlete, and personal problems as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that eventually led to your split up with Steve Audane. Now, coming up, we're going to talk about Ann Audane, her pro career with Nike, her final race, and her ongoing commitment to a special race for women in Boise. Talk about that again, and maybe some problems that female athletes still are dealing with. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport.
Support for 2 Main Street with David James comes from listeners like you and from Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management, guiding clients through all stages of their financial lives to help them achieve long-term peace of mind. Details at BergerWealthServices.com.
Welcome back to 2 Main Street, and if you're just joining us, my guest is world-renowned runner Ann Audane, a world record holder, Olympic athlete, and the first professional female runner signed by Nike. This native of New Zealand now lives in Evansville and remains active in the running community. And Ann, in those early days, runners were paupers. I know you say in the book you're scraping to get by, actually begging for funds to compete. Your parents didn't have a whole lot of money, so you had to work a couple of jobs, and you were teaching and then still trying to train and then make a career out of this. And you talk about the showdown over shamateurism, you call it, where you got shamed for collecting prize money. And that continues to be a struggle for female athletes. I know they're still trying to get equal pay.
They are. I mean, that was a big when I came to the United States in 1981, I was an amateur. The reason I came to the United States is because my coach, John Davies, thought that I would be much better at all the distances that women were being allowed to run on the road. Some of my male compatriots had already come here and were having success, and they too encouraged me to come to the United States. And so I packed up and bought what savings we had and started to run on the road racing circuit in, I think my first race was April of 1981. And so I immediately found my niche. I found that these races, the 5Ks through to the 10 miles, were just perfect for me. And in June of 1981, Nike, which was a very young shoe company based in Beaverton, Oregon, and Phil Knight, who's the founder, co-founder of Nike, they decided to put up prize money for a road race in Portland, Oregon, a 15-kilometer road race and in downtown Portland, and put up $50,000 prize money, actually equal prize money. Was a big, that was a big deal. Equal prize money for the male and female finishes, 1 through 10, $10,000 first prize. And I was all in. I mean, I was going to go and do this. I knew there were going to be consequences worldwide, not just in the United States, but with the Olympic and the International Track and Field Federation. But I had raced in Europe all through my late teens and early 20s with my fellow New Zealanders, and had watched the men receive all the under-the-table payments for competing in Europe. And so I just wanted a chance to earn money too. This was going to be above board, though, not under the table. So I lined up for that race, and I thought, if I finish fifth or sixth, I'll earn enough money to stay in the United States a little bit longer. And but, you know, I was a very strong uphill runner, and this race went 5 miles up and 4 miles down to the finish. And I just found myself in the lead at the top of the hill and ran scared to death all the way down, and ended up winning. And I received $10,000. Now, this is 1981, and I was only earning about the same amount as a school teacher in New Zealand. So to run and win a race and win $10,000 was just a huge shock, excitement. But I was in an awful lot of trouble because I received a lifetime ban from the sport. I was only in the nation on a visitor's visa, so it's completely illegal to earn any money if you're on a visitor's visa. You know, the IRS is trying to figure out what to do with all these runners that are suddenly earning money. So it was a big day for the sport. And if you fast forward, like I've talked about, you know, being banned and so forth in earlier in the interview, it took, well, what is that? It took about 16 months for me to get reinstated. But through that time, all the American road race directors just welcomed all of us and supported the change, and they didn't want the under the table stuff. They wanted everything above board. And of course, about 3 days later, I did my first Nike contract at the Peachtree Road Race in Atlanta, writing it down on a table napkin. And it was for $400 a month, and obviously all the shoes and clothing. And I was just absolutely over the moon. And so, everybody now, you know, you look at the million-dollar contracts that all the sports people and the women are getting, Serena Williams and all the tennis players and soccer. I mean, and I look back at that thinking that $400 a month, and I was over the moon. So, but
and
that, yeah.
And you were considered to be the first female professional?
That's what they're saying. In terms of running, it has to be. I mean, it's not like, now the gal I did it with, we're still friends, and we could certainly say, yep, pretty much, because we sat there at that table. But it has to be, because I was the first one to win the to win that prize money, and it was only 3 days later that I was in Atlanta at the next race. There was no one else who signed.
So no one has challenged.
No one's challenging it because no one else could have signed in that amount of time.
So anyway, you're making some money road racing, and I think you eventually go to the Olympics in Los Angeles.
Yes.
What race did you run there?
I actually ran the inaugural women's marathon. Very frustrating for me. The reason being is that up until Los Angeles, the longest distance in the Olympics for women was the 1,500 meters. And so they fought really hard to get the marathon into Los Angeles. And I was in all support of that. The hardest part for me was that I'd had the world record in the 5,000 meters and number two in the world in the 10,000 meters. They did not add those events. So I had a choice of going, you know, the shorter distance or the marathon. And everybody, because of my road racing success, was like, oh, you got to go for the marathon. You got to go for the marathon. Well, there were two things wrong with that. First of all, I didn't want to ever run the marathon. It didn't suit my personality. I was way more competitive and liked to race more often, where if you're a marathon runner, you really just got to do the training and turn up for the marathon. So psychologically, it didn't suit me. And I really had this fear that that distance was bad for my feet. Now, I had to qualify for the New Zealand team, and so I entered the Chicago Marathon in 1983.
And for people who don't know, how long is a marathon race?
My marathon is 26.2 miles. And so I entered the Chicago Marathon in 83 because I had to run a certain time. Now, I actually ran the fastest debut marathon by a woman when I ran Chicago. So now everybody's saying, my Lord, look how fast she ran in her first marathon. But I just hated it. I hated the training for it. I hated it mentally. But I qualified and I got to LA. But, you know, LA was really, really hot day. And I was a novice. I was a novice. So I was in sixth place and I just, probably with about 6 miles to go, and I collapsed because of the heat, ended up in hospital. I mean, the crazy thing is that Nike put me on in one of their laboratories and put me on a treadmill and tested me and did all the VO2 max and everything. They predicted with my ability that I would be the first woman to break 2:20 in the marathon. And I got off that treadmill and they're all so excited with how I tested. And I said, yeah, but there's one problem. I don't want to run marathons. Mm-hmm. I don't care. And so that was the thing. It was just I didn't want to run marathons. I eventually ran four total. But I hated every moment of it. But, you know, I ran 2:31. It's not too bad.
No.
But it just to me mentally, I thought I was risking running in the future. I thought, sure, I was hammering my feet. I just thought that was not a smart thing for me to be doing.
Also in your book, An Uncommon Heart, you talk about your final racing days, your final races, and then that last one where you finished and you said, that's it. Tell us about that race.
Well, it wasn't actually the race when I made the decision. Here's what actually happened. It was 1991, and I'd had a good year, had won a lot, and I had won the Virginia 10 miler in October for the sixth time. I had one more race to go, which was a big women's race in Boston on Columbus Day. Yeah, Columbus Day. And I was getting ready for that race, doing my last training session before I traveled to Boston. And John always got me to run a hard mile my last training session before.
Your coach, John Davies.
Coach John Davies, yes. He got me to run a hard mile. That was always my last workout before I traveled to a race. And so I'm out, and I had a guy in Boise that was my training mate through those years. He was a school teacher, had run cross country for Boise State. And so we were training partners. He was just great because he never tried to do anything more than my coach wanted me to do. It wasn't like he ever competed with me. Just ran side by side. So we're warming up, and we start off to run this mile, and we get halfway mark, and Bob says to me, well, Annie, when are we going to start the mile? I said, well, we have. We're going through the halfway mark. And he said, well, we've only run 3 minutes. Now, to most people, that for the half mile, and that sounds really fast, but for me, that was too slow. And I just stopped, and I said, really? And he goes, yeah, we've only gone through the halfway in three minutes. And I stopped, and I go, okay, that's it. I'm done. And he said, well, that's okay. He says, it doesn't matter. You've only got one more race for the season. Doesn't matter. You know, you've had a long season. Doesn't matter. I go, no, I'm done. He goes, what do you mean? I said, I'm done. I'm retired. I'm quit. I'm done. I was 36 years old. I was still winning. But it was the mental side where I was tired. Mm-hmm. At that point, I'd had 22 years of really hard racing and training and whatever, travel, everything. Mm-hmm. And I go, nope, I'm done. And in that case, I can say I won the last race
there you go.
Of my career.
Yeah. So let's go back. Yeah. Let's go back to your personal life away from racing. You eventually break up with Steve. Okay. And also you go back and you search for your birth parents. And what prompted you to do that, Anne?
I got to like my early 30s and with all the success that I had. And a lot of times people would ask me, do you know who your parents are? And I go, no, I don't. Well, Dad, my adopted dad, at this point, New Zealand changed some laws. And they opened up the adoption laws to allow an adopted child and a birth mother to go looking for each other. And if they didn't want to be found, they could veto their information for 10 years. So Dad found the brochure for this, about how to do it. Mm-hmm. And he handed it to me and he says, now, this is just going to be between you and me. Because my adopted mom really didn't want anyone to know I was adopted. I mean, she just, that was...
So this is a pact between you and your adopted father.
Yes. Okay. This was and he says, you know, I'll help you do this. And so it was really actually surprisingly easy. What you did is you filed for your original birth certificate, which is really quite something when you see it, because you've got this identity. My birth certificate that I have, and my maiden name, my family name was Garrett, in my adopted family, Anne Garrett. So you've got this birth certificate, and it says Anne Frances Garrett, and your parents are Ivan Garrett and Valerie Garrett. These are my adopted parents. That's my birth certificate that I carry through life. So then it says you can apply for your original birth certificate. So I get this original birth certificate, and I am Eileen Maria Butler. My birth mother is Margaret Ann Butler. And then father, it says father, no name, just says European. So you get that, and it's kind of a whole new identity, right? You've got two birth certificates in life. So then they help you. They've got a whole place in the government set up to help you, kind of like social services, I guess. And so the next step is to track your birth mother to see if there's a marriage certificate for her. Well, first of all, it said my birth mother was only 17. So you find her marriage certificate, and she's Margaret Ann Butler, married a year after I'm born to Johan Ustuk. Well, at that point, that has to be my father. It says my father's European, and there it says he's Dutch. And 1 year later, really? So it's like, okay, I think my birth parents got married. So then you try and find them on the electoral rolls. They help you. Well, they were really bad. They never voted. So you couldn't find them. And so it was really... And then the fact that I'm named Anne, I'm thinking, on her birth certificate, it has her parents, and her mother's name is Olive Anne. So at this point, I'm thinking, Mum and Dad are holding out on me. They've named me Anne. They had to know who these people were.
Mm-hmm.
Nope, just an absolute coincidence.
Wow.
So we actually tracked down my birth grandmother, Olive Anne Butler, and called up and... Do you have a daughter called Margaret Ann? And nope. She completely denied her daughter existed. And we asked about three times, and she finally got mad. And she said, yes, I do. And she's married to a Dutchman. And she said, so you could tell there was all this animosity.
Sure.
And so anyway, I got to meet them. Yes, full. My birth parents, I'm the oldest of seven full siblings. And we met, and the one thing that she asked me to do at that time was that I would never contact her mother.
Hmm.
So that she didn't want her to know that she'd found me. Oh, and of course, the main thing was that then they had to sit down and tell the other six that they had an older sister. And it's like, okay, you have an older sister. That's the first surprise. Second surprise is, look at who she is. And so they'd all come through knowing me as the athlete.
Sure.
So they knew me.
Well,
but they didn't know me. Suddenly I'm their sister.
I guess the big question now is, how did Ann Aldane get to Evansville, Indiana? And you had to Chuck Hubrey is, I guess, the reason for that.
Yeah, he kind of says, well, what, when I get asked, it's like, how on earth, what are you doing in Evansville, Indiana? And if Chuck's actually standing with me when that question gets asked, he'll just put his hands out. He goes, well, what's not to like?
So how did you guys meet?
We met, I had retired and had made the decision to stay in the United States, and I still had about another 18 months doing some work for Nike, and so they sent me to running camps around the country. And so I went to a running camp in North Carolina, and Chuck, who just loved to run and was pretty good, decent runner here locally, and so he had gone to this running camp to be a camper. And he heard me speak, and at that point, you remember the ArtsFest River Run put on by Pat Shoulders and his team, and Chuck was part of Pat's team, and Chuck came back and said to Pat, well, do you know this person? And Pat goes, of course, you know, I know who she is. And Chuck says, well, I think, you know, I can get her to come to the Arts Fest. And so, and I just started my event in 1993 in Boise. And so Pat brought me in to do the Arts Fest in 94. And I watched Pat MC his finish line and how well he treated everybody to the last person, just the language he was using, which was exactly what I needed for someone to do in Boise. So I hired Pat to come out to Boise to MC my race, mm-hmm. which he actually did for the next 7 years, and his wife Lisa, and then I came back here for the Arts Fest, got to know Chuck. Fast forward, we got married in Pat and Lisa's house in 97, in front of their stained glass, empty liquor cabinet, and Lisa was my maid of honor. So there
well,
you go.
Well, Anne, this has been a fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed your book, An Uncommon Heart, and thanks for letting us spend some time in your running shoes. A great career, your book, a great read. You're an inspiration to others who, despite their challenges, can still cross the finish line with their hands outstretched and their heads held high, as is pictured on the cover of Uncommon Heart. And I wanted to have you read the final paragraph from your book, Anne, if you do that.
Sure. And nearly every day, no matter where on the planet I find myself or what else is going on in my life, I will head out the door and put myself in the wind. My feet pick up and move to the beat of an ancient melody. My arms swing in time-worn arcs. And as I begin to move, slowly at first, then faster, I become that little girl again, flying across the sandy beaches of Waiheke Island in the South Seas, while my grandmother watches from up on a windy hill.
I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport.
Support for 2 Main Street with David James comes from listeners like you and from Evansville Regional Airport, hundreds of one-stop worldwide destinations on 3 major airlines to 5 hubs, and non-stops to Orlando on Allegiant. More at flyevv.com.
Two Main Street is presented by Evansville Regional Airport. You're listening to 88.3 WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, Owensboro.